Hello, and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat and host of this program. Offbeat is a proud supporter of WHIV 102.3 FM. I invite you to visit offbeat.com to read our October digital edition, featuring a cover story about singer-songwriter Dana Kurtz, who you may also know as Lulu in the band Lulu and the Broadsides. You'll also find stories about Alex McMurray, Johnny Vidakovich, Kenny Neal, Charlie Musselwhite, and Chapel Hart, just to name a few. Check out our album reviews, original videos, and live music listings at offbeat.com. And don't forget to vote in the upcoming Best of the Beat Awards for your favorite acts and bands. The ceremony will be held on November 10th at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. And you can also purchase tickets at the website. Here at WHIV, we've expanded our music format to infuse more Latin, hip-hop, blues, and jazz into regular programming. Tune into Inspirational Brew for gospel and inspirational music on Sundays at 6 a.m. or NOLA Nation with Louisiana-produced hip-hop Fridays and Saturdays at 10 p.m. It's fall fundraising time, and I encourage you to call in your donation now by dialing 504-623-9448. That's 504-623-WHIV, or visit our website, WHIVFM.org/support. Today's episode will begin with an interview I had with MJ Dardar, a songwriter and recording artist originally from Venice, Louisiana, who is currently based in Lafayette. His sound combines rhythm and blues, country and soul, and he has a new album debuting in November titled The Reason Why. In the second half hour of the show, I will be joined by Roland Guerin, a New Orleans musician whose work draws from a wide spectrum of genres, including American folk, blues, zydeco, rock, and jazz. He describes his sound as prog funk, and he's put together a new band for a forthcoming album that's titled Bridge to Open Waters. We'll hear a portion of a live concert recording that took place at Snug Harbor at the conclusion of this show. I am thrilled today to be joined by MJ Dardar. He is a musician and recording artist, originally from Venice, Louisiana, way down there at the tip of the river in Plaquemines Parish. He's now based in Lafayette. His music combines blues, country, and soul with influences that include Sam Cooke, Johnny Lang, Wilson Pickett, Bear Reinhart, Don Henley, Clay Cross, and Jeffrey Gaines. His debut album, or debut EP, Rust, had 7 tracks with 6 originals, and he's recently signed with Red Stick Records in Baton Rouge for a new album titled The Reason Why. Welcome to the show, MJ. Glad to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right. I usually like to start by asking any musician in Louisiana how you got your start. What was your earliest influence when it comes to music?
So my mom was a choir and worship leader at the church that we grew up at. So I started playing, I think probably bass was the first thing I started on, probably about 13 years old, something like that. And, you know, back then it was like, if you wanted to be in the worship team, you know, it was all whoever wanted to volunteer is like, come on, man, we'll teach you how to play something. And so that's where I started, you know, started playing guitar, moved on to piano, and figured out how to, you know, halfway sing a few years later, you know.
Right. I know that kind of came later for you. Of course, you grew up down there way, like I said, way at the end of the river, the last community in Louisiana before you hit the Gulf of Mexico, where the Mississippi River literally empties out. What was it like growing up down there?
I didn't think it at the time, you know, but looking back at it now, it's such a strange, you know, place to grow up. You know, one of the stories I always tell people is that we didn't have a fast food restaurant in the entire southern end of the parish until I was probably 15 years old. You know, no Walmarts, no chain stores. So we would, you know, once a week, we called it going to town. You know, everybody would pack up their family, you know, get in the van and go drive to Belchase or to New Orleans to go to Walmart just to get groceries and come back, you know. And it was just a normal thing. We all thought that was completely normal. And, you know, I left there when I went to college when I was 18. And I went to college at a small school, Nichols, in Thibodaux, Louisiana, and relatively small town, but I had a Walmart right next to my apartment. And I was like, man, I'm like in the big city now.
Exactly.
It was really, like churches and bars and, you know, a couple mom and pop restaurants, and that's it. Yeah.
Right. No, it's quite a journey down there. One way in and one way out. One road. Does your family have deep roots there in Plaquemines?
My dad's family is actually from Golden Meadow, Louisiana, and they moved to Venice when he was a kid. And just kind of stayed there until Hurricane Katrina. And then they moved back to Lafourche Parish. My mom or dad neither of them originally from Venice, but both grew up in Venice.
So tell me about your songwriting influence. Like I said, your debut AP was Rust, and I'm curious to know how you came up with that title and the songs that led to these six original songs that you recorded.
Yeah, so the influence behind that record, I guess musical influence to start with at the time was I wanted to do kind of a rootsy soul slash country record, but including these, I want to make sure I have the big horn sections in it and things like that. Kind of influenced at the time was, again, Wilson Pickett. Anderson East was a big one. I actually covered his song on that record, and that was Satisfying Me. And one of the main reasons why I covered it was to give a feel to the rest of the musicians that were recording on the record that this was sort of the sound that I was going for. And so I pulled that song in really just to kind of reel the songs together and say, this is kind of the central theme sound-wise for the record. You know, story-wise, the whole record was sort of written about my personal divorce, you know, sort of the things leading up to it and the aftermath of it. Rust is actually a line from the song Out Alive, which was that was the most streamed song from that record. And there's a line in the second verse, red turns to blue, gold turns to rust, really a reference to a wedding ring, right? And so that was the reason for the title of the record. But yeah, the theme of the record is kind of centered around, you know, that relationship and sort of the build up to it and the outfall of it and you know, the aftermath.
So I read you keep a journal. Did that inspire some of the lyrics?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have I have a co-writer that I do all my stuff with. His name's Jerry Martin. And we write things sort of in a backwards way than most songwriting happens, even in my own professional career. But so everything sort of starts as, you know, words on paper. I write everything out sort of in a poetic format in a journal. Sometimes it's just a lot of stuff doesn't really even make sense and I've got to clean it up later. And then from that, I pull out the portions of it that I think are important to tell the story behind the theme of the record and then come up with melodies, basically, usually either slightly on like guitar, but mostly just kind of through vocal melodies. And I record those vocal melodies in voice memos. And then Jerry and I get together and we actually put the music to the melodies before there's any music, you know, on it. Right. So it's words, vocal melodies, music, which is sort of the backwards way of doing things, but it works for us. That's all we've ever done together. So yeah, that's sort of the writing process behind it.
Well, of course, everybody has their own approach. Sometimes it strikes like lightning and sometimes it just takes a little longer to really get words down on paper and then matched to music. Now, you said you went to Nichols University. I believe, as I read, you majored in petroleum studies or something alongside, maybe engineering, I guess, related to petroleum.
Yeah, so petroleum services is what I graduated in, which is essentially like a petroleum technology degree. It's centered around, working in well construction, well drilling, well control. It was odd that even really happened. When I first graduated from high school, I started working offshore 14 days on, 14 days off. And Nichols was the only school at the time, they may still be, I'm not sure, but at the time that had a rotational school schedule. So if you worked 14 and 14, you could go to school on your 14 days off. And so that was the main reason why I got in, because I was already working in that environment. And it was just kind of the easiest path for me to get in school and get out and also maintain employment. Yeah.
Well, I know, you know, for instance, Chris Christopherson was a songwriter and musician who worked on the offshore oil industry. Does working in that industry in any way influence your songwriting, or has that played any role in it?
Yeah, man, it's surprising, man. Like whenever you spend a lot of time with folks on drilling rigs and things like that, there's a lot of people out there that are musically talented, and you really don't have anything else to do. So I can tell you, like, many times that we've gotten in the galley or in a locker room and people have broken out guitars and we've sang songs and wrote songs. I mean, it's oddly familiar in that environment that you know, most people that haven't been there wouldn't think. But in this area, you know, in working in the offshore deep water environment, I mean, you're talking about people from Texas, Mississippi, Louisiana, for the most part, and a lot of musical talent in those areas, you know, and people that are doing it as a part-time gig or just as a hobby. Some people have started doing that and become professional musicians. You know, buddy, a local musician, Frank Foster. I don't know if you know who that guy is, but same thing with him, man. He's working on drilling rigs and now he's, you know, touring Nashville country artists. You know, so there's a lot of talent out there, man, in that environment for sure.
Well, I can see there'd be a lot of room for sharing stories, you know, as well. Like you said, when you're out there all together, you know, with only the ocean around you, of course, the Gulf. I can see where it would develop perhaps an unusual camaraderie with everybody on the well together. So you mentioned some early influences, you know, Sam Cooke, Johnny Lang. Were these musicians you were listening to from your parents' collection, or how did those big names come to influence you?
Yeah, so I mean, like, as far as like the Sam Cooke, Wilson Pickett stuff, I mean, obviously those are things I kind of grew up listening to. And you know, Sam Cooke always, to me, is one of the greatest male voices of all time. Unbelievable the range that he is able to convey, and not sounding like he's at the top of his range. It's very weird to describe it, but it's like you hear a Sam Cooke song, you know, and you think that, oh, I could sing that, and then you actually try to sing, it's like, wait, that's way up there, you know. But he's got so much depth to his voice that it doesn't come off as this high pitched voice, even though he is sort of teetering at the top of what would be my range, right? So it's just an incredible voice. Vocally, I always love Sam Cooke. You know, Wilson Pickett's another one. You got the deep grunts and the growls and all that stuff. You know, I kind of pull that from folks like him. And, you know, Johnny Lang was more of an artist that I listened to when I was a older teenager, early 20s. Really dug his vibe. You know, he was like the little skinny white kid playing blues music. You know what I mean? The first time I ever heard that guy, he was probably only 15 years old, came on the radio. You would have thought that it was a 50-year-old blues artist, you know, from Memphis or something. And then I saw a video and was like, look at this guy. It's like some little dorky white kid, you know. But yeah, he's musically a huge influence of mine. Still, I mean, I follow everything he records and performs on. So yeah, love Johnny for sure.
When you were at Nichols, were you performing in between your studies?
Yeah. Back then I was in, I went through a couple of different deals during the college times. I was in a original rock band called Corvina. We actually did some touring, many tours and things like that back in those days, and, you know, played weekends when we weren't, you know, out on the road and college was in and all that stuff. So did that for a while. After I graduated, I started getting more into kind of the solo stuff, doing like, you know, these acoustic shows, and which I really did mostly cover music at that time, but oddly, it gave me a chance to really kind of hone in on playing guitar a lot more. And I actually wrote a lot of songs back then during the time when I played the most covers ever, right? So it was just odd how that worked out. But yeah, I mean, I've always in some form or fashion been playing music since, you know, really since I was 17 or 18 years old.
And how do you pull your band together? How did you meet your fellow musicians?
So, Jerry and I, Jerry is my guitar player and co-writer. Funny story about how we met was I was at a wedding in Thibodaux for a friend of mine. I was in a wedding, actually. The groom, my friend Kenny, walks up to me and he says, man, Megan's going to be mad if you don't go up and sing something with the band. And I was like, well, what do you want me to sing? Like, well, why are you asking me this today? You know? And he's like, I don't know anything, you know. I was like, okay. And I kind of blew him off. Well, he winds up going to tell the band to call me out on the microphone. So I go and sing. And I think we did Drift Away by Dobie Gray. Little did I know the band was actually in between singers at the time and they were looking for somebody. So I sing a song and I walk off stage and I go to the bathroom, and Jerry finds me in the bathroom. He's like, "Hey man, you want to be in a band?" And I was like, "What?" And he's like, "Yeah, we were looking for a singer right now. The guys loved you and all this stuff." So I wound up joining his band at the time, which was called The Groove, which is kind of like a top 40 cover band, party band type thing. They do mostly weddings and private parties and things. And so he and I started, this was like 2013 or something, together. And this whole writing process for Russ was happening during this time where we were, you know, playing a lot on the weekends, but doing these private parties. Once we started writing songs together, then it was just natural that he was going to be the person to take it to the road, you know? So, the other guys in the band, Tim Belanger is our drummer. Tim went to Nichols with me. He was in the band at Nichols. We've played in bands together since we were in college. You know, he was a drummer in a band called Light Up District that played with us a lot downtown, Thibodeau, home of Morgan City, all that. So we've been knowing each other forever. So that was the obvious choice for me. Mark Kravanek is the bass player. Mark, from Homa, lives in New Orleans. He and I played together in a band out in New Orleans called the Nola Dukes Band, subbing and filling in. We kind of met each other through that. And then he's also pretty tied into the Homa music scene, which is where, you know, we're kind of based out of, basically. So we pulled him in. Incredible bass player. I mean, the best one that I know. I mean, it's unbelievable. And then keyboards, we cycled through a few. Teddy Baudouin plays with us a little bit. He's the keyboard player for The Groove. Currently, right now, Brett Guillory is our most active keyboard player. We've had two or three kind of rolling out. But the core band is myself, Jerry on guitar, Mark on bass, and Tim on drums. And then when we do bigger shows, we'll pull in the horn section. Obviously, for the first record in particular, those songs are really horn-centric. Jason Parfait, Ian Smith, 504 Horns, they've come play with us, you know, when we do some of these bigger events where it's, you know, bigger stages, bigger budgets, things like that. But yeah, it's that was sort of how it happened. It was people that we've been connected to, you know, for years that kind of just made sense, you know. And, you know, one thing that we did on this last record, or the reason why that we didn't do on the first one, was the people that are in the band are actually the ones that are on the recordings. The first record we did, you know, I kind of just pulled in some folks that I knew that I thought would have the right sound, even different people for different songs. But, you know, one thing that I sort of wanted to do on this record that we didn't do last time was we got in the room with basically what I handed them was a pre-production demo. It was Jerry playing guitar and me singing, and just that's it. That's just the song. And then your parts, we're going to write them in the studio. So we got everybody in the room and played all the songs live, you know, got them until we got the parts right that we wanted, and recorded them all, you know, in the room together. Something I always wanted to do. You know, it's how records were made back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, right? Every record that I had ever been a part of was, you know, you go get a drum track down, and then you go put your bass track down and your guitar tracks on top of that, and your keyboards, and then fluff it all up. And then, okay, now the vocalist is ready to come sing karaoke, you know? So I didn't want to do that again. Not that I'll never do it again, but I just wanted to know what it was like to do it that way. And, you know, I always use this example that when you listen to a Chris Stapleton record, the drummer that Chris Stapleton is playing with on stage is the drummer that's on the songs. And you can hear all those signature things if you really listen to it, that drummer is doing. And I just wanted a little bit of that for us, you know? So that was kind of the thought process behind it.
Well, I can see why you'd want to do that. There really is no substitute for being able that energy, you know, you share among each other versus technology that just allows you to just layer it all together.
Right.
We're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause here at 102.3, and I'll be back to talk more with MJ Dardar.
The vibe of the city for human rights and social justice. WHIV 102.3 FM.
102.3 FM reminds you the midterm elections for the state of Louisiana are on November 8th. Here's an amendment on the ballot for November 8th. Do you support an amendment to prohibit the use of involuntary servitude except as it applies to the otherwise lawful administration of criminal justice? Check out all the amendments up for vote by downloading the free mobile app Go Vote. That's GEAUX Vote. We'll see you at the polls Tuesday, November 8th. Another community service reminder from the station dedicated to human rights and social justice, 102.3 FM, WHIV.
And welcome back to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat Magazine. And if you're just joining us, I am in conversation with MJ Dardar, a musician and recording artist who's based in Lafayette. He has a new album coming out in November. It's titled The Reason Why, and it's been recorded with Red Stick Records. So tell me, MJ, how did you get connected with Red Stick Records?
So when I recorded the first record, Rust, we were kind of unsure about where we were going to do it. And, you know, we were still in conversations about, you know, what musicians we were going to use. Jerry was in a band called the Williams Riley Band, which is a original country band from here, Lafourche area. But they were doing some major touring, like touring with Edwin McCain and some other bigger artists. Robbie Smith was out on the road with them. I think he was doing sound engineering or production. If I get that wrong, he's going to kill me, but I think that's what it was. Whenever we were looking at places to do it, of course, Jerry has his own studio as well, but kind of stifles you whenever you have to be a musician in the band and also worry about engineering and production, you know. So we wound up calling Robbie, who has a studio in Prairieville called Audio Smith. We recorded the record there, and he really loved it. You know, it was one of his favorite projects, and he is one of the owners of Red Stick Records. And it wasn't very long after we put that record out that he contacted me about a recording contract. So the Red Stick is Robbie Smith, Keith Arsamont, and Travis Thibodeau. Travis was the touring keyboard player for Journey, and he also wrote Take My Hand, which is that famous Wayne Toop song. He actually wrote that when he was like 13 years old or something, which is crazy. Wow. So that's like the record, you know, C-suite, I guess. And so they hit us up about a recording contract, and it was a no-brainer for us because we were already recording the record at our own cost anyway. You know, so they're like, man, why don't you come be a part of this? And that's really how it happened. And it was cool. We went in to Audio Smith. You know, we've got Audio Smith Studios basically got at our disposal. But as Robbie's, same thing with Jerry and not want to record in his studio, Robbie is now doing the engineering. So instead of having to worry about his own studio and kind of having people, because the studio's at his house, we actually outsource it now. So we're recording the record at Brignac Lane Studios, and Robbie is just coming in to do the in-studio, you know, engineering. We've got a couple studios now under the label's belt that we're kind of versatile now. We can go a couple different places, so not limited to one studio. Kind of good for the artist. They get to pick really where they want to go and who they want to get involved. So that's pretty cool. It's been a great experience so far. And Deanna Scott, my manager, she manages all my social media and scheduling and booking and all that stuff. And it was funny, like about 2 months after I had signed the deal, Robbie actually reached out to me and was like, he said, man, we're looking for somebody to pick up our marketing piece at Red Stick. And what do you think about me asking Deanna if she wants to be a part of the label? And I was like, man, whatever, you know. So now my manager is actually part of Red Stick Records ownership as well. So all in the family.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like everything has fallen into place. So I mentioned the title of the new album is The Reason Why. It includes 9 original songs. Tell me what listeners can expect whenever this debuts.
One of the things that is going to be a little bit different than the first record is it's a little bit more on the alternative country pop soul versus the sort of the horn centric sound that we had on the first record. You're going to hear a lot more kind of contemporary country pop sounds as far as the music is concerned. Story wise, you know, as the first record was kind of the end of a relationship and the aftermath of a relationship, this one is sort of still personal, but more about, you know, it's current day, right? It's, you know, the moving on part, you know, where are we now? You know, other, you know, relationships that we're in, you know, a lot of things centered around, you know, my childhood, my current family environment, current relationships, and really just kind of walking through, you know, where we are in the aftermath of everything that's occurred in the last, you know, 5 years. So I'm really excited about the record. I think it's really more personal because it's a little more broader topic, and it hits on a lot of things for me. I had a plan when we did the record that I wrote it in such a way where it was sort of written in the same chronology as the stories of the songs, and the songs are going to be in that order, right? And so I released Marianne in the Dark first, at the same time, like around May 6th, and those songs will actually be the first and last song on the record, you know, the bookends, if you will, and then all the other seven songs will fall kind of in between those. So, but yeah, no, I'm very excited about it. I think it's going to sound a little bit different, a little bit more modern than the last record, but I love it. It's my favorite thing I've ever done.
And how'd you come up with the title, The Reason Why?
Yeah, so in the song, Mary, you know, kind of the tag in that song is you are the reason why. And really, it's just kind of speaking sort of back at the first record that you're the reason why this, you know, we've had to do all this moving on and our lives have changed. And, you know, you're here and I'm there. And it's kind of looking back at it and saying everything that you're going to hear moving forward is because of you or because of what, you know, our relationship or our past relationship.
That's life. You build on the good and the bad, the experiences you've had before and move forward. Of course, we're going to listen to one of your songs. It's titled In the Dark. Tell me about the inspiration behind this.
Yeah. So In the Dark is really about a tale of two people in the record, a relationship in which there is some semblance of privacy about the relationship. You know, one of the partners, one of the people in this relationship is in a relationship with someone else. And so it's talking about kind of having this love in private. And when will we get out of this moment where, you know, we can let everybody know that this is where we are and this is our relationship and it's real. And you know, we want to let the world know that this is our love and this is our story. But the other partner is sort of not willing to do so. So In the Dark is sort of alluding to that. You know, our relationship is only known to each other and we're living in the dark, right?
And how can folks access The Reason Why?
It'll be on all major streaming services, Spotify, iTunes, Deezer, Tidal, all that stuff, Facebook, TikTok, anywhere you can hear music, it'll be there. I'm anticipating right now at end of November release date. I'll have a hard date here in the next few weeks, but likely be the last week, last Friday in November.
And you have a website. What is that website?
It's mjdardarmusic.com.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, MJ. I really enjoyed our conversation. And where can folks hear you live? Where are you playing in coming weeks?
So end of October, we will be in Houma a few times at the Balcony and I believe at the Canal Bar. November, we're going to do a couple of bigger shows. We've got Varsity Theater. That's going to be on Black Friday.
In Baton Rouge,
that's great. Grouse Room in Lafayette, I'm working backwards. The Grouse Room in Lafayette on November the 18th and Music Cove in Houma on November the 11th.
All right, very good. Well, again, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, David. I appreciate you having me and thanks for taking the time.
In the Dark.
Surprise!
we've got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV-FM and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org. WHIV-LP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
Welcome to Bee Cafe. I'm David Johnson, host of this program on WHIV 102.3. I'm thrilled to be joined by Roland Guerin. He is a songwriter and bass player here in New Orleans who has worked with many legends, and Alan Toussaint, Dr. John, and Alvin Batiste. He has assembled a new band, and they're coming out with a new album titled Bridge to Open Waters. And he describes his sound as prog funk. So welcome to the show, Roland. Happy to have you here.
Hey, thank you for having me here.
Roland, why don't we go ahead and try to define prog funk? How did you come up with this genre title for music?
Well, I like prog rock a lot. You know, the way I have my bass tuned is from low E to high F. And so the range itself is a greater range than a guitar, but it's just pitched lower. You know, in prog rock, like one of the modern bands in prog rock is a band called Intervals, who I really enjoy. A lot of the movement is guitar driven, you know, with a lot of different intervals, a lot of different moving parts that's very orchestrated, but it still has a very spontaneous feeling to it. And the bass is very prominent in it as well. My musical influences kind of take the front seat, like for a bass sound in the basses that I play. I'm heavily influenced by the sound of early Prince, you know, on his guitar, and the sound of early Stanley Clarke. And so, you know, it's got that strong, deep mid-range tone. It's very percussive and very energetic. A lot of my influencers, like the people that I'm deeply influenced by, that I've met and studied under, like Alvin Batiste and Alan Toussaint and say Dr. John, that's New Orleans funk and New Orleans jazz and just expressive music. And so in a lot of the songs that I write, it has the sound of prog rock with the influence of New Orleans funk music and jazz as well. But, you know, we both know that jazz in the day was just the popular music, and the jazz was just a name given to it. And so, you know, it's New Orleans funk of the legends and the popular music. You know,
well, it's a fascinating combo. Yeah. I had a chance, of course, to hear your band at Snug Harbor on October 2nd. And I see what you're saying. It is definitely a fusion of all of those sounds. I'm curious, let's start, go all the way back. When did you first start playing an instrument, and what were your earliest influence?
My mom. Yeah, she plays bass. She can play drums and piano. And she plays zydeco and blues. Heavily groove oriented. You know, and, you know, but my first instrument was viola. Played viola in middle school for a few years, and then switched to guitar for 1 year in eighth, switched to bass. In the ninth grade, continued with electric bass and upright bass. But we would have jams like all the time. There was always a drum set up at our house growing up. There was always piano. There was always, an organ, and just different instruments all the time. We could just pick them up and play. We'd all, you know, sing and dance, and there was always food, and, you know, so it was that influence, you know, from my family that just made everything natural and feel natural.
That's as Louisiana as it gets. Does your mom play with a band?
Right now she doesn't, you know. She's we're actually going to drive up pretty soon and celebrate her 80th birthday. And but that doesn't say that she doesn't shed. She still practices. You know, you go in her place, and she's got her bass on the stand, a nice bright blue Ibanez, her amplifier right there, her guitar, you know, on the other side. And she's got a resonator guitar as well.
Fantastic. I'll have to have her on the show sometime. I'd love to hear her play.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So I'm curious. So obviously you got a good grounding on music through your family and through your school. Where did you go to school in your younger years?
Valley Park Middle. Before that, it was Westdale Elementary. And that's actually when I first started playing viola.
In which city?
In Westdale. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Baton Rouge. Okay, very good. Okay. So when you started professionally, how did that come to be?
I started playing professionally in high school. They used to, there were some clubs in Baton Rouge and they were kind of sneak me in the back. And
I've heard that story many times from other people. If you got the talent, they'll find a way.
They would sneak me in and sneak me out, you know? And so I started like 11th and 12th grade in high school playing professionally. And kept it going throughout college. I went to Southern University to study with Alvin Batiste.
And you became a member of his band, the Jazztronauts, correct?
Oh, yes.
So, yeah. About that experience.
I was always holding on by the seat of my pants, I'm telling you. You know, he would, oh, man, such a great person. He would teach us how to teach ourselves, you know? Mr. Bat, you know, was a clarinet player who, of course, could play flute and saxophone and piano and drums. But I remember, here's a good example. I remember one day I was passing by. I was a marketing major at Southern University. And so I took extra classes. I was just always on the move. So I was walking by with my upright through the music building. And I heard him playing this incredible lick, but it was long. And so I was like, wow, that's just really hip. And so I just quickly passed his door. And with the horn still in his mouth, he said, Roland, come here. And so I went in. He said, take your bass out and learn this. I was thinking to myself, this is so difficult. I'm not going to be able to do it, you know? He didn't even think twice about it. He slowed it down and kept playing it over and over again. And in about 15 minutes, he started speeding it up and speeding it up and speeding it up. And after about 20 minutes or so, I had it at tempo. And he would tell me, like, okay, the clarinet, you know, all instruments in music, it's all related. You know, the clarinet, you hold it like this. And, you know, with your bass in the clarinet, you have to have a strong connection with your finger in the fingerboard for the note to sound. With the clarinet, you have to cover the hole for the note to sound. And he said, your hands are curved. Same with an upright bass. Same with the piano. Same with holding drumsticks. Same with the trumpet. He said, also, don't forget the use of natural gravity. You know, in terms of playing piano, use just the natural weight. You don't just sit there with your fingers going up and down really fast because that's almost impossible. You have to use your wrists and your arms and just the natural weight. And the same thing with the upright bass. You know, just let your hand drop down and do the majority of the work for you. And so that was the kind of way he would teach. Very natural. And there's no impossibles.
Fascinating teacher, obviously somebody who was a true master of his craft, and to combine music and technically song in what you're
doing. Oh yeah.
So you've gone on, of course, to play, as I mentioned earlier, some other big names in Louisiana, among them Alan Toussaint. How did you wind up working with him?
I've been playing in New Orleans for a bit, you know, throughout college, going back and forth. And a few times I was hired by Alan and his son, Reggie Toussaint, to sub for Chris Severin, who was in the band, or at times David Berard. They called me to play on Alan Toussaint's record called Connected. This was 1996. And I played on half of the album, and then Chris Severin played on the other half of the album. And then I would get more regular calls, like whenever the possibility was present. At that time, in 96, I had left Mark Whitfield's band. And I was in Marcus Roberts' band. In 2008, I left Marcus Roberts' band. And so right at that same time period, I think maybe within the same month or so, I got a call from Reggie to see if I was available to go out on the road with Alan and play. And I remember after the first set, Reggie was like, or right before we went on, we were in the dressing room. And Reggie was like, man, what's going on? How you been? I'm glad you're out here, you know, with us. And I was like, yeah. He said, how's Marcus doing? I said, well, actually, I just left the band. And he said, really? And he said, well, right now we don't have a bass seat in the band filled. And we love your playing, and we would love to have you in our band if you would have us. And as Alvin Batiste would say, well, wah, wah, wah. I would love to be in Alan Toussaint's band, you know?
Yes, that's quite an invitation.
Yeah, and that was it.
And before we go on to discuss more about your new work, we have to talk about, of course, Dr. John. You were his final music director. Yes. Tell me what it was like to work with him.
Oh, man, it was such a joy. This was back-to-back, like literally back-to-back.
From Alan Toussaint to Dr. John.
Yes. to hear somebody that comes from the same tree of hypnosis that has their own branches of hypnosis.
Indeed.
You know, and it's like, it was so hip because I could clearly hear the similarities and differences. I could clearly see and hear his playing from his personality and the personality in his playing and all the honesty and all the cleverness in his songs. You know, that's just how he was. He would see life. He would see the honesty in all the things, good or messed up. And he could see the root of it. And then he would take that and write it.
He was as genuine as they get.
Oh, my goodness. You know, Bandstand, Daily Conversations. You know, he was real and 100% trooper. I remember one time we were playing at Jazz Fest and it was raining so hard that water was starting to like come on the stage, like, you know, like sheets of rain. And it got so bad, I covered my pedal board. I unplugged the stuff and kind of pushed the stuff out the way so it wouldn't get drenched. Dr. John was still on the piano looking around like, what? The piano was starting to fill up with water, you know, but like, that's who he was. It's like, oh no, we're in it. You know, this is my life, you know?
Well, I tell you, Roland, no matter where you go from here, the fact that you played with Alan Toussaint and Dr. John is quite a story. We're going to take a brief break, a pause for the cause, and I'll be back to talk more with Roland Garin.
All New Orleans, all the time, 24/7, WHIV 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
102.3 FM reminds you, the midterm elections for the state of Louisiana are on November 8th. Here's an amendment on the ballot for November 8th. Do you support an amendment to allow local governments to waive water charges that are the result of damage to the water system not caused by the customer? Check out all the amendments up for vote by downloading the free mobile app GeauxVote. That's GEAUX Vote. We'll see you at the polls Tuesday, November 8th. Another community service reminder from the station dedicated to human rights and social justice, 102.3 FM, WHIV.
And welcome back to Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, host of this program. I'm so pleased today to be joined by Roland Garin. He is a songwriter and bass player. He's assembled a new band, and they're coming out with a new album. It's going to be titled Bridge to Open Waters. So, Roland, tell me, in this band, you get all these guys together.
Part of us go pretty far back, pretty far back. Part of the band is just brand new. But everybody has heart, you know? And that's probably the glue. Everybody cares. We have a caring band.
That's the first thing you need to accomplish, yes.
Yes, yes. You know, somebody that actually cares enough to listen, you know? Because we're in a relationship. We're all there listening to each other and responding and having a willfulness to be there and support each other. And it's not about, you know, showboating the whole thing.
I know you got Kyle Roussel on
PM. Oh, yeah.
And
Kyle Roussel.
And Ashlyn
and, Parker. Ashlyn Parker on trumpet. John Jones on drums. We have Sam Taylor on saxophone. And John Mastis on guitar. Everybody can play. You know, everybody can play.
I heard it first Harbor, and I cannot wait to have it such that I can play it here in my comfort of my own home eventually.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
But, you wrote, you know, many songs are going to be recorded. About the inspiration behind this, and just about songwriting in general, how does that inspiration hit you? Is it like a lightning flash, or does it kind of come over time, or how does that work for you as a creative musician?
There's a few different places in which, I mean, it really happens all the time, every single day. Every single day, new songs come. And I have probably 18 or 19 albums worth of music, like full albums worth of music on top of the 7 that I have out. Sometimes it'll come, you know, when I'm shopping and I kind of run a little bit with the cart and look for an open aisle and whip out my phone and start and start humming. It comes a lot when I'm cooking or doing dishes. I like to do dishes by hand. And I'll, same thing, put the voice recorder on. Sometimes it'll come right when, like while I'm sleeping. And I'll be like mid-stride in a dream thinking to myself, like, man, that sounds great. Wow, whoever wrote that, wow, they're on it. It's like, wait a minute. Nobody else wrote that. And then I try not to say anything when I wake up so I can retain it and then get to a bass or a voice recorder and get it down. 9 times out of 10, once I finish the voice recording and name that, the rest of the song unfolds, just like if somebody was flipping pages in a full novel. Like everything unfolds. The story, how the lyrics are going to go, the sound of the song, the groove of the song, the melodies and the whole thing. So if I had time at that moment, I could just sit and just complete it.
Very impressive. I've read some of the titles of your songs and of course them at Snug Harbor, Wall Decor. I'm curious to know what that song, what the inspiration behind that was.
I got really influenced, as a lot of people did in many different ways at the start of the pandemic. You know, I really, because my background is marketing also, I started like really paying attention to people. I started paying attention to businesses, how things were shifting, how people were trying to reach and feel out how to maneuver and how to navigate, how to gain people's attention. And I started seeing, you know, attention spans started, it was already pretty bad, but it started getting worse with individuals, you know. And I started thinking about, well, how do people really see things? How do they see themselves? I know a lot of people with the social media and how it's grown want to portray a certain image, but how do they really see the world? And then what kind of color is that? You know, is it a rich color? Is it one of the rainbow spectrum colors? Is it a color that has a feeling or a weight to it? Like if we could see life and describe it in a color, what would that be? And that's what
thought, yeah, a lot of thought obviously into your compositions. And we're going to close out the interview by listening to one. It's called Checks and Balances. A lot of people think that's kind of a government term, but it never seems very balanced these days. But
no.
Anyway, but you're taking a different spin on that phrase. So tell me what Checks and Balances means to you in regard to this music.
It's another thought about life, about, you know, if we look at a checkbook and then, you know, especially me growing up when my parents were, you know, teaching me how to balance the checkbook. But, you know, it's something that we could carry around with us and then do transactions with. And so it has value. But if we have that kind of thing with us, and then we have checks and balances in our life, you know, it's how we use checks and balances in our life as it pertains to us, and then the interaction with other people. And so that's more of the meaning behind the song.
Well, it's brilliantly done. I know folks can learn more by going to your website. And what is that again?
It's www.rolandgarin.com.
All right. And we're going to give a listen now to Checks and Balances. And thank you so much, Roland, for joining me today.
Thank you, David, for having me. This has been a joy.
All right. And we'll look forward to hearing more when the new album debuts in 2023. That's the goal, correct?
Yes, sir.
And the title of that will be Bridge to Open Waters.
WHIV 102.3 FM.